It's like, what better opportunity to create for yourself than moving from East Africa to America as an immigrant and starting a completely new life, right? And so
totally.
I didn't really realize it, concretely, but that, subtle theme, right, of creation of the best opportunities are ones that you create yourself. And what in my journey looked like these kind of micro jumps from, going from a law school to a startup, and so I consider these micro jumps, knowing where my family came from, but right. The same kind of, underlying philosophical sentiment.
What's up, boys and girls? We have what many are calling the best episode that we've done on the Deal Maven podcast. We got Ramin Sheth on this one. He has bootstrapped his business from zero to $60 million. He went to Harvard Law School, McKinsey, then he became the CEO of this business that he now has private equity involved in. He's invested in over 75 companies as an angel investor. We talk about going to Ivy League schools, parental pressure, leading with empathy with employees. Ramin is like a framework master. And so there's probably 10 frameworks on how to think through any of these situations that you're facing in your life. So check it out. But remember that this is different than most podcasts because it is not free. If you listen to it, then you owe me a 5-star review. And if you think that it's worse than a 5-star review, then give it to me anyway, please. Thank you. Goodbye. I'm stoked to have you here, bro. I'm excited. I was reading all of your stuff. I want to get into your story because I think it's super interesting. But in your bios, you have trying to make my parents proud. Where did that come from? How has that driven you to great places or potentially not so great places at times?
Yeah. Wow. Nobody's ever asked me that question. That's a really insightful question or astute observation. I feel super fortunate. My parents are awesome. We're super close as a family. But man, has their life been anything but easy. Dad, grew up in Uganda in East Africa. He grew up in a time period in which, East Africa was kind of a war-torn zone. He has stories of, walking on the street at 12, 13, and a tank pulls up to him and, somebody puts a gun up to his head, right? In high school, when he was in high school, Idi Amin, who was the dictator of Uganda in the 70s, basically kicked out everybody of South Asian descent from the country and said, you've got weeks, if that, to basically get out of the country. And my dad came to the U.S. on a scholarship to college, which is a different story. So my grandfather was really a blue collar worker at Esso Oil, which was the predecessor to Exxon. And there was a scholarship opportunity, for the kids of Esso Oil executives. And my grandfather, was a former freedom fighter that fought for India's independence. And, as he was working inside Esso Oil, he basically clawed and fought for my dad to have an opportunity, for that scholarship. And his perspective was actually pretty simple. It was, if my kid is in the mix, my kid can compete, with the best of the best. Sure. But as most things are in the world, right, oftentimes you don't get the opportunity or you don't get the chance to compete. And so, he wasn't highly educated or hyper educated, but he found his way to kind of get his kid an opportunity. And then his kid, my dad, crushed it, right? He was one of the first people in Africa to take the SAT, right? It's a fun and kind of weird story. And he got a scholarship to Tulane University in New Orleans. And so as Idi Amin, kicked all the South Asians out of the country, my dad came to America, his whole family, his parents, two younger siblings, they went to England. And my dad was 15 years old in the U.S. in the 70s. So remember, there's no cell phones, there's no internet. And so just the courage and the conviction to fly, not even fly, right, take a ship, to go 10,000 miles away, right, know absolutely nobody, have absolutely no money, right, and say, I'm going to figure it out. It's just unbelievable to me, right? What a privileged background for, my older sister and I to grow up in a house that was, stable and safe and not in a war-torn country and not as refugees, right? Not by any stretch having to kind of figure it out completely ourselves. My mom has a very similar story. I grew up in poverty in India, you know, got her first pair of shoes, right? She was a teenager, not an easy upbringing, you know, as well. You know, my parents have done, you know, great, especially for their circumstances, right? They've lived a happy life. They, you know, they're fully integrated into this country. And so it just always gives me a lot of reflection. It gives me a lot of gratitude, you know, for the hardship that they've faced to give us, you know, the life that they gave us. It makes any challenge I go through feel very inconsequential comparatively. Yeah. Whenever I feel, you know, down or upset about, hey, something's going on in the business, or, you know, this happened with a partner, or this happened with a customer, an employee or so, you know, there's a reason I kind of put that in the short character bio on Twitter, because it's always just a reminder for myself to, you know, to say, hey, you know, how fortunate are you, right? Like, these problems are, they're relative problems. You know, I don't think it's fair to say that they're not problems, but, you know, if you have good grounded perspective, they're not real problems in the grand scheme of things. So, yeah, I feel super fortunate that, you know, they gave our family the life that they gave us. And, you know, they always instilled this value system of work really, really hard, you know, believe in yourself to the ultimate degree, and be a good steward of your community and be kind. And if you live a life like that, then, you know, all the successes in the world are great. But ultimately, at the end of the day, as we all, you know, I believe, figure out at some point in time on our journeys, the most important thing is, you know, is to be respectable, good, honorable people. And so I'm super grateful, you know, to my parents for instilling that. And that's what it means when, you know, I constantly think of, you know, trying to make them proud.
It's interesting because you went to great schools where you have high achieving people. And a lot of times you went to Duke, Harvard for law school. And a lot of times I see the people that are massively high achieving and it can be a double-edged sword where they feel like the parents set the bar so high that it's impossible to reach. And they kind of like try to live their life through the eyes of their parents and, you know, constantly are trying to get respect for their parents. And the parents are kind of like withholding of like, no, it's not. It's, well, you were only in the top third of your law school class at Harvard. You weren't summa cum laude. And so, like, you know, we'll get it on the next one. And so a lot of times when I talk to lawyers or investment bankers, people that went kind of like this, the yellow brick road professional path, realizing that they ultimately want to do something else, letting their parents down is one of the last dragons that they have to slay in order to kind of go and do what they ultimately want to do. Did you feel that at all as you were like Harvard Law to McKinsey, not being a lawyer, being a consultant instead, or were they always just kind of like, hey, don't waste this opportunity, but ultimately whatever you want to do, you know, we're behind you?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is where I give a lot of credit to my dad. I think his experience of, you know, just coming here and having to figure it out, what he instilled in me, and my mom, you know, equally did as well, but I'd say my dad, you know, played a very seminal role in this, is his belief was always in me, right? It was like me, the player. It wasn't, you know, what school was I at? What major did I do? What job was I at, et cetera. He always viewed all these things, you know, like you mentioned, whether it was Duke or Harvard or McKinsey or anything, he viewed these as, you know, moment in time, you know, phases that I would be at. But he was always betting on the jockey, right? And so the encouragement was always there of, let's make a sound decision. Let's talk through, right, both the emotional side and the intellectual side of why you're making this decision. But we never had an impasse, you know, upon the decision itself. And my, you know, my routes, you know, were weird routes, right? So like, I went to Duke as a son of immigrants, and I majored in philosophy. There's no job for people that are philosophy majors. Like, that's not practical at all, right? I was able to kind of convince, you know, the narrative or the story by saying, hey, it's this, you know, great platform to go to law school. Okay. Yeah. Then I go to law school and I never practice as a lawyer. That's kind of odd, right?
Was the story to your dad, like, I'm going to practice law, look at Law and Order, like, that's going to be me, look at Suits, whatever, was the idea?
Yeah, totally.
I'm going to be a lawyer.
Yeah, 100%. I had this thing growing up where I was like, I'm going to be the first, you know, Indian person on the Supreme Court. Right. Awesome. I loved debate. I loved politics, et cetera. Yeah. And then I got to law school, and you went to law school, Raleigh. Like, it's nothing like that. Right. It's completely different. Right. If anything, I was doing M&A law, and, you know, maybe we can double click into this experience if it's interesting. But I had an experience my second summer at a law firm where you know, basically it was just very evident and very clear to me that, you know, the last thing I wanted to do was be a corporate lawyer.
Yeah.
Came back to law school.
Do you mind
Cleary,
saying
the firm? Cleary Gottlieb. Cleary Gottlieb.
I was at Skadden. Yeah, yeah. I was at Skadden in New York. I went to some McKinsey recruiting things.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, these are all the firms that I was choosing between Cravath, Skadden, Simpson. I mean, they all the same firms, right?
Yeah.
These corporate law firms in New York City. Right. And it was really clear to me that that just wasn't what I wanted to do. So I came back to law school and, you know, I just cold emailed companies that I thought were interesting. I cold emailed their CEOs. And these were founders and said, hey, I think if I was in your shoes, this is how I would think about the business. Have you considered this? Have you considered that, et cetera?
Which is ballsy. And, like, that's a total.
Yeah. Total and it turned out like a lot of them responded. Most of them responded. Right. And we're like, hey, that's interesting. Right. That somebody's kind of sending us this note, et cetera. And it led to me taking the New York bar the next day, flying out to San Francisco and spending 2 months at a startup out there. And then when it came time to say, well, you know, it's October and it's kind of the start of your first year summer associateship, I told Cleary, hey, thanks, but no thanks. And I stayed in San Francisco kind of ever since that. Right. And then, you know, along the way, you know, again, did different things after that, whether it was McKinsey, whether it was, you know, our business, you know, et cetera. I've always had this belief that the best pathways in life are the ones that are just completely self-created. And I think I've put a framework around that and kind of a cleanliness, you know, around it as an idea to be able to articulate now. I couldn't really articulate that idea for the longest time. I kind of felt it in my gut and it was very evident in my journey that it was just these kind of, there's no way to make sense of these weird, you know, jumps at kind of moments in time, right? In those moments. But I've come to realize that it was always because of that gut feel or that thought process of the best opportunities. I firmly believe, and I still firmly believe this, I tell this to people all the time, the best opportunities are the ones that you create yourself. And if I really abstract that to first principles, like where did I get that thought process? Like what better opportunity to create for yourself than moving from East Africa to America as an immigrant and starting a completely new life, right? And so I didn't really realize it, concretely. But that, you know, subtle theme, right, of creation of the best opportunities are ones that you create yourself. And what in my journey looked like these kind of micro jumps from, you know, going from a law school to a startup. And so I consider these micro jumps knowing where my family came from. Right. But the same kind of, you know, underlying philosophical sentiment, right, that carried those through.
Mine isn't a fully fleshed out framework other than Cinderella syndrome, which is what I call the idea of you hoping for your Prince Charming to come and sweep you off of your feet and give you everything that you ever desired, right? Before the clock clucks 12 at midnight. And, you know, I went to these great schools because that's why I went to law school. That's why I went to the best school that I could, was because I felt like if I was associated with these institutions, that my career Prince Charming would come and give me a riskless path where I would never have to lose anything and have all up and to the right, all upside. And it was for me looking when I got to Skadden, which for me was kind of like the top of the corporate peer. It was like seeing the top of the mountain and being like, this is bullshit. This sucks. I know it's not this. So like, what's the other option? You know what I mean?
I think what gets conflated is, you know, can you make great economics? There's no question. I mean, you're like Skadden Arps is one of the top, if not the top M&A law firm in the world, right? Like you're going to make great economics, et cetera. But at what cost, right? One of the things that, you know, was very what started to become more and more obvious to me was the people that do really well in life, right, are the ones. So let me segment this into two ways. A, the people that do really well in life are the people that genuinely can endure, right? You get the compounding value in years 5, in years 10, in years 15, in years 20. If every 3 years you're looking at where you are and you're saying, I hate my life, you're never going to get the actual compounding value of anything that you're doing, right? So I think you have to find zones in which you can endure. Now, early in your career, I think it's great to like build up skills, be at great brands, et cetera, because despite what's said on Twitter, like the real world does operate in a way in which it gives you a hell of a lot of credit when you're associated with great institutions.
For sure.
You know, and so on and so forth. And there's really great skill sets and learning that you can do when you're in these intensive programs at top consulting firms, law firms, banks, you know, so on and so forth. I think the first part you have to really kind of think through and be comfortable with is can you endure, right? So why was I at McKinsey for 3 years and then left? I was a top performer at the firm. I had great support internally. I was absolutely on the right track. But I looked at the guy to my left or the gal to my right, and they loved it, right? And I don't know if they loved the job, but maybe they loved the status associated with the job or the economics associated with the job. It didn't matter. They loved something, which made them, stay up until 2 a.m. on a Wednesday night, to finish that last thing, to only to get up at 7 a.m. to talk to the client. And that endurance was very obvious to me that they would continue to excel and succeed and endure because there was some part of it, again, whether it was the core job, the status, the economics, whatever, or maybe all together wrapped in one, that motivated them to keep pushing. And for me, it didn't motivate me to keep pushing. And so I knew I was going to lose at that game.
Yeah.
Right. And so I had to have kind of the heart to heart in my own mind to say, this is not a game that you're going to win at. Right. And I think that's the latter part of, this whole journey that we all go through, which is, who wants to look back at the end of the day and say, well, I made a bunch of money or I did X, Y, and Z or so, but I wasn't really happy doing it, or I wasn't really fulfilled doing it, or it came at significant cost, to family or friends or sure. hobbies or whatever else is important, in your life. Right. So I'm a strong, strong believer that you have to figure out a situation in which you yourself can endure in and kind of compete in. And oftentimes that looks very wonky and weird and different to someone that's equally as smart and reasonable, et cetera. And it's because, it turns out like there's so many ways to win and you have to find the game that's the right fit for you, as opposed to trying to like aimlessly emulate somebody else's path.
How quickly into McKinsey did you start getting the inkling that you were exerting more effort than, that's how I felt like at a law firm is like, I just feel like it requires more effort for me to do the same output, and it has nothing to do with competency. It just has to do with desire. Like I have to fake my desire in order to get this thing done. And for me, it happened happened in the first week of an M&A, going to the printer, doing an S-1 for a public company. I'm like, this is so much more boring than I ever imagined it to be. How long did it take for that to settle on you at McKinsey?
Yeah, I think if I was at a law firm, it would have taken similar to your time frame, because it did, right? That was my second summer after 8 weeks. I was like, there's no way I'm doing this. At McKinsey, it took a little bit longer. And I think it's because at McKinsey, it was more directionally aligned, with where I've ended up, right? There, again, I think if you're on Twitter, you read kind of generally, people always like to make fun of places like McKinsey. Oh, there's no value. People over there, what are they doing, et cetera. It was the most unbelievable business education ever, period. My second week on the job, I was talking to the COO of one of the largest payments company, a company worth, $10 billion plus, on how they should be thinking about an industry moving, acquisition.
Yeah.
Right. And in one sense, it's like, what business did I, 2 weeks into the job, right, at 25 years old or 26 years old, have any business kind of, doing that? But in the other respect, you look at that and you say, wow, clearly there's so much value, right, in this brand and in this institution, that senior executives like that are fully cognizant of the fact that there are junior people like this that are staffed at these projects and that are leading these projects in many cases. And they're willing to engage, right? They will engage with you. And so my time at McKinsey was actually, it was good, right? Like I learned a ton. There were super smart people there, et cetera. It just at some point became very obvious that, continuing to spend time there would be honing the art of consulting.
Yeah.
Did you want to become a better consultant as opposed to really to the first 12 to 18 months, which was like a rocket ship MBA, right? In learning about actual business and pragmatically, right?
I think
so. Probably around that 1.5 to 2 year mark, the new business learning had kind of precipitously declined, and kind of the idea of learning how to be a good consultant was. That was the toggle that wasn't super interesting, to me.
Did you start brushing off the resume and like, okay, what's my next step? Or was it assertive on your part? Or just like, what did it start looking like when it started to dawn on you like, I got to get out of this thing? What was that new? Because this whole new exploration, I know for me, I had to shed the identity of being a lawyer that I'd held on to for 8 or 9, you know, I was kind of at 18. I was like, that's what I'm going to do. And that's a core part of who you are. And to like shed that, to go into kind of the new unknown after you're educated and doing all those things as its own new daunting experience, whether you do it at 26 or 46, you know, it's the same process. How did you go about exploring that?
Yeah, it, so there's definitely an identity kind of work stream or portion of that. You're absolutely right. Right. Which is you kind of have to shed this idea of, hey, I've been at these storied brands or, you know, large name institutions or whatever it might be. And you have to kind of untangle that from your own self-worth, right? If anything, you have to recognize that like the opportunity set is actually all that more interesting if you're able to untangle and unable to shed. I have to imagine like you see this with either, you know, former classmates of yours or people because you went to the same types of schools. A lot of people can't do that.
Most, right?
Most cannot do that. They cannot untangle that. It's very difficult to do so. And for me, I believe, you know, back to your Cinderella analogy, I believe everything in life is up for the taking. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that anybody gives you anything. I think if you want something, you have to go take it. I don't think you have to do it in zero sum ways or, you know, so on and so forth, but I think you have to go take it, right?
Today's episode is brought to you by the Exit Operating System. If you run a business right now and you are thinking about selling it one day and you want to know what you should focus on in order to maximize your exit value, go to exitos.io and sign up now. Peace.
In my sense, it was probably this naivete of, hey, any and every option is open to me, right? I didn't ever believe in that. You'll be familiar with this because you went to law school. This like the famed phrase of exit options, right? Everybody would always solve optionality for exit options, right? Optionality, right? What law firm are you going to that's going to give you the most optionality? Yes. Well, maybe I was naive, but I was like, that doesn't really make sense to me. Why wouldn't you just go be really good at the law firm you're at and create your options, right? Like this idea of exit options, et cetera, is you're like, you're almost placing your hope that you're going to get to this place that you want to go off of some secondary proxy as opposed to just some your value derivative. Creation or your abilities or your skills. Exactly. Some derivative as opposed to yourself. And so I just started thinking through it kind of very widely in terms of what are the possibilities that are open and with very high agency, right? That I can inform this decision. I can enforce this decision. You know, and the only thing really getting in the way of that would be me, right? And so I'm really glad I went down this path of kind of small business. It was, it wasn't obvious at the time. There were a lot of folks internally at McKinsey that were, you know, I had one partner I worked very closely with that told me, you know, I think you're absolutely destroying your career, and I think this is a terrible move.
Were your parents on board?
You know, I think my parents were on board. By that point in time, we had had enough of these kind of like micro, you know, again, like non-consensus, non-obvious decisions that were made that, you know, we kind of go through the same process. It was, let's talk through the decision. Let's understand it intellectually and emotionally. We kind of have this framework. Let's talk through the intellectual side. Let's talk through the emotional side. And at the end of that, as long as you're making an informed decision, this is what I always really respect about my parents and hope that I can, you know, pass on and kind of parent when my wife and I have kids, is just this idea of put the right level of conviction and support right behind your kid. They always had conviction and support, right? Like the actual decision itself didn't really matter, right? The conviction and the support part was the important part. And look, they're normal humans, and their level of exposure to this world is, you know, it is what it is, right? And so it's not as obvious, right? And some of these decisions are kind of weird, right? And so they kind of scratch their head a little bit. But then, you know, we get through enough discussion and they're like, actually, you know, I don't know if this is the right decision, but you seem to think it's the right decision and we believe in you, right? And so let's all go for it kind of together. But it was, you know, there were a lot of people at McKinsey that thought, hey, this is really weird. This doesn't make a lot of sense, et cetera, you know, which is actually helped me create another framework in my head, which I always think about, which is this idea of what is low status today that's going to be high status in the next decade, right? Because it turns out that most of the things that people kind of scratch their heads at or say, hey, that's a terrible idea, et cetera, it's because they're low status things. Like nobody would look at you, Raleigh, and say, hey, you shouldn't go work at Skadden. Now, that might be the worst decision in the world for you. I think from an opportunity cost perspective, clearly, you know, through your business success and your exit, it would have been, you know, 1/20th probably the economic outcome that you've had, right? There's no question about it. But from a status perspective, from a signaling perspective, et cetera, I'd argue it would have been higher signal, right, to be an eighth year associate or whatever at Skadden than, you know, to have the escape park
for
business,
sure,
right? Or escape the room business, sorry, trampoline park business, It would have been higher status, right? And so I think I've started to think more and more through, and again, it's kind of been one of these accidental frameworks of constantly thinking through what is low status today that's going to be high status in the next 10 years. Because all the alpha is there, right? So now, again, similarly, if you go on Twitter or you talk to people, this whole entrepreneurship through acquisition movement or boring businesses or whatever is super in vogue and super popular, right? I think that's interesting because I think that that gives a signal of a maturing market in some respect, but it also means that the alpha is starting to come out because a lot of the inefficiencies riding away, right? And a lot of the, you know, and a lot more people are thinking about it. It's going to be a lot more competitive, you know, so on and so forth. I think it's a massive world, and so, you know, everybody that wants to do it, I'm sure will do fine. But it is a, it is easier to jump onto that pathway now because it is not as low status, right? But as it becomes higher status, you know, the economics also start to change a little.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, a lot of these things are, you know, many of these things are high status and they'll always stay high status. I think there are certain things that are low status that will always stay low status. And that's probably not the right place to operate either. But the things that are low status that you have a perspective are going to be high status over the next 5 years, 10 years, whatever. I haven't found something in that low status to high status paradigm yet that hasn't been interesting. Like another example of that is I graduated Duke in 2011. It was super low status to do startups then, right? I mean, everybody that was a high achiever that was coming out was going to law school, medical school, investment bank, consulting firm, right? Whatever, PhD, whatever it was. Startups were super low status. Well, it turned out that graduating in 2011, right, at the beginning of a massive, you know, new decades worth of a bull market and doing technology companies was like the best decision you could have probably ever made.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of Paul Graham's has that really famous blog post on like prestige. Like if it was really fun, no one would have to make it prestigious, and like prestige is fossilized inspiration. And I think you could probably say prestige is fossilized alpha. Mitt Romney, you know, when the private equity guys in the 70s and 80s, Rubenstein, Carlyle, all those guys, when they were doing private equity and LBOs, right? Like the thing that everyone that goes to HBS or GSB that they all want to do, right? It wasn't this like high status thing back then. It was just like, I don't know. I think it's allowed. I think we can do it. And prestige is probably the best signal to follow for low alpha, right? By definition, like,
yeah, 100%. And a low alpha, and I think like generally just like unhappiness,
totally,
right? Like I think you really, really have to love some other factors about jobs like that, because nobody I've met, none of my friends at least, you know, say that they love doing it. And again, maybe it's a different generation. Maybe people in the past actually did love doing it, et cetera. And maybe it's a selective friend group, but I have not found a single friend that has said, I love being at a big
one. I love being a clerk. I love being a clerk for a federal judge. And it's hard to like segment it, because what it really just comes down to is like I love being on Law Review, right? It's like, it's trying to scratch your own insecurity about what you are worth.
I think that's a lot of it,
right?
I think a lot of it is an insecurity. And then I think there are definitely folks that have like this idea of like, I need to do this to get to a certain pathway, et cetera, which is fantastic. What I always just share with friends, or just generally, I won't say I'm perfect at it, but I always try to do it, is just be intellectually honest with yourself about why you're doing something. It's perfectly okay to say, hey, you know what? Yeah, I don't love this thing, but maybe I'm trying to pay off my loans. Right. Or maybe I need to do this thing to get to another thing, you know, et cetera. In regulated industries like the law or medicine, et cetera, you do have to do, you know, sometimes step through those hoops, like a clerkship to maybe if you want to be a judge someday or a professor or whatever it might be. Right. I think as long as you're intellectually honest with yourself, then you're in good shape. I think when it becomes challenging is when you've kind of lost the script. Right. That's when I think the tilt for, you know, unhappiness, lack of fulfillment, finding yourself in a zone where, you know, it's kind of the worst of all worlds because you've lost that ability to be honest, at least with yourself.
And I think a lot of times, like I have some investments in medically based businesses, pharmacy style businesses, where it's a lot of these people that have gone, you know, kind of Hippocratic oath type people of, you know, they want to contribute to society, and they get themselves so wrangled in that idea that they need to be doing something for society's sake, not for their own sake, that they can't even be honest with themselves on like, I'm doing this so I can get filthy rich, or I'm doing this so I can be famous. Yeah. The ends justify the means. Like, I'm doing it just because I want to make a shit ton of money, and like, that's it. And they can't even get to that for themselves. Like, you know, they have to wrap it in. It's going to contribute to this. You know, they want a virtue signal about
creating impact. Yeah. And I'm doing X and I'm doing Y, et cetera. And I think it's super important to be just really honest with yourself. I try to do that with our employees, right? I try to ask people when they're coming to work for us, you know, if in the next 3 years, you know, we're sitting inside this room and everything has gone according to plan, right? At the company level, personally, et cetera, everything has gone according to plan. Like, what does that situation look like to you? And it's so interesting to hear the answer. I mean, there are some people, you know, there are different people that are great at our company that answer the question in totally different ways. Some say, you know, I've made X amount of money, right? And that's great to know. It's great to know that they're economically motivated. It's some people that have said, you know, I've really made an impact in our community. I've really, you know, driven value for customers, et cetera. That's great. There's a service-oriented mindset. There's some people that say, you know, I've brought along another 25 people, you know, and changed their lives and made their careers. Great. Hiring, training, recruiting, et cetera, is important to you. It's really revelatory about what people's motivations are. And there's no wrong or right answer. I mean, there's always a wrong answer, but there's, let's say, spectrums of right answers. What's most important is just knowing, you know, what is that spectrum? Like, what is that specific thing that makes that person tick? It's funny. You do a lot of work around M&A and exit planning and deals and stuff. And I'm curious to get your take on this. One of the things that I've appreciated just more and more, you know, whether it's we've looked at companies to purchase or, you know, just doing deals, et cetera, generally, is how much more when you're a beginner, you anchor on diligence being about, you know, the numbers and the Excel spreadsheet, backs, the org chart and this, that, and the other. And how much when you're more experienced, how much diligence is just about, you know, kind of playing the man, right? Or playing the woman, right? Getting to know the actual
humans,
people and the person, the mindset, the culture, the humans behind the business.
Totally.
Right? As opposed to, you know, just the financials, et cetera. And that's really, I think, you know, that's the way the world operates.
Sorry, the investing that I've done since selling the trampoline parks and the escape rooms has been probably most approximating growth equity for these businesses that don't have any enterprise value of courses, online business, you know, kind of the thing that has zero sex appeal right now that I'm hoping has some, you know, some ability to have asset value in the future of buying these digital product businesses and these people that have audiences. And the mistakes that I've made have been when I let the economics of the where I think that the economics can overcome the ambition of the person that I'm going to be running the business with on going forward. And so I've learned that for myself, the, you know, cause we're buying majority stakes, 50, 65%, something like that. We're usually coming in cause we're going to be the operators that really try to operationalize the business. So I just try to get as clear a sense of possible of what a win is for the founder that's going to stay in and kind of nurture the community going forward, and what a win looks like for the rest of the team. I made the mistake in my first business. And again, I know this for myself. I'm so massively economically driven that I tend to, those are the rose colored glasses that I see everyone else on my, I'm like, oh, like, I'm just going to like, you're going to make more money. So like, you should be good. And so I've learned to like, do personality tests and see what their contributing factors are in terms of like contribution, giving back, and not minimizing any of those things. I made the mistake in the trampoline park business to your grapes and watermelons analogy. Mine is canoes versus cruise liners, of like not giving enough economic incentives to the rest of the team earlier on in the business. And I'm in the process right now on some of the companies that I've bought of like putting phantom equity in place and really trying to phantom equity for those that are really economically incentivized to go to the next exit, and then equivalent things to phantom equity for those who care less about the economics. I mean, like the Munger quote of like, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcomes, and like make the incentives as simple as possible. Absolutely. And on a long enough time horizon, everyone will act in their self-interest, however they perceive it to be, whatever they're oriented to, that self-interest will play itself out. And so if you are trying to keep people there through scare tactics, manipulation, or, you know, social justice causes that they don't perceive to be in their own self-interest, like they'll find a way to act in their self-interest, whether that's within your organization to its detriment, or whether it's outside of the organization for their own sake, wherever they can maximize their self-interest as they perceive it to be, they'll do it. And so in an M&A and on an acquisition side, like I'll never buy something without being able to talk to like the team. You know, like, I mean, financials are great, P&Ls are great, balance sheets are great, but like, I want to have some time with the team alone with them, and really try to get a sense of like where the skeletons are. Cause they know where the, I mean, you know, if you're going through an M&A process, a lot of people are making a lot of money to hide the skeletons in the closet that you're dealing with. The employees, if you give them a safe space to do it, they'll tell you where the skeletons are. And then you just have to balance, like, are you a victim? Are you a victim mindset? Are you just complaining because like you're a complainer, or are you showing me something that I really need to pay attention to? And, yep. You know, you just make the mistakes and keep it rolling.
That's a lot of this, right? Like we were talking about this a little bit before we hit record, right? But I just have this firm belief that, and it kind of parlays with the same thing I just said on the diligence side, which is, the intellectual side of business is not that difficult. It's the right. emotional side of business that's really difficult. And, you know, you can't simulate what it feels like, you know, to have a major customer drop you, or a partner manipulate you, or an employee you thought was loyal leave out of nowhere and right. go to a competitor, right? I mean, you just can't, you know, COVID, you can't simulate how you actually feel and how you actually react, you know, through these types of events. And that's where I think the danger sometimes for people that are earlier in their career is, you know, how do you, if you just listen to podcasts or read books or, you know, business books or, you know, watch business, you know, movies or whatever it is, it's actually really dangerous because you can recite everything under the sun. So you can feel like you know business, armchair, but man, you don't really know business. Like the analogy is basically if we said, okay, you know, I know you're a big pickleball player. If you wanted to go learn pickleball, right? You could go spend 6 months and say, well, I'm going to watch every TikTok and I'm going to, you know, do this and that and whatever it is. And after 6 months, you're like a walking encyclopedia, you know, every new team owner, you know, the league economics, you know, all the shot names, you know, all the strategies, et cetera. And then month seven, someone says, okay, great. We'll pick up a racket and a ball and hit it. And you have no clue how to do it. And I think that's exactly the same. I think it's really obvious in that example. Obviously it's like, okay, if you want to play pickleball, you need to get out on the court. I think it's less obvious in business, and I think that's actually really dangerous. I think a lot of people do actually genuinely feel that they have all the knowledge, they know everything when they listen to podcasts or read business books or read business tweets, et cetera. And I think that's missing the main point, which is, you know, the hard part about business is the emotional part of business, right? It's dealing with humans, it's managing the stress, it's thinking through, you know, situations that have really big impact and not having all the information and not having all the time and having to make a call and then having to live with the, you know, circumstances, et cetera. Yeah. That's the tough part about running a business, right? The other stuff, you know, you can learn and you mostly do learn on the job. It turns out that most businesses ultimately just come back to, you want to sell some stuff and get some dollars in, and you want to pay some people and have some dollars flow out. And ideally more dollars are coming in than dollars are going
out. Because I have this question written down for you of things that you had to unlearn from law school and McKinsey and running a business. One of the things that I had to unlearn from law, whether it was practicing law or going to the University of Chicago, was the idea that like, I'll be more and more successful as I get smarter, and And as long as I'm learning more, like that most of business is an intellectual pursuit. And if you know the problem intellectually, you'll be able to get further and further ahead. And I underemphasize network, collaboration, empathy for, because it sounds so like, it's like, oh, this is like a San Francisco, like VC ping pong table, like kombucha in the canisters, whatever. It sounds so not useful. But like, if you look at the books I've read over the past year, right, they're less and less about Jim Collins and getting the right people, you know, they're less like business books or Porter's Five Forces or any of the like intellectual problems and paradoxes that you see. And they're so much more about like finding empathy for people. Part of that has been my wife going through a cancer journey and like seeing even optimizing for success and then having this thing that's totally outside of your control, you know, bearing down on you. What do you feel like as you went from McKinsey, which is mostly solving an intellectual problem that, I mean, you're getting paid, McKinsey's getting paid seven, eight figures to solve the intellectual problem and doing it on a spreadsheet. What are some of the things that you feel like you've had to unprogram from Harvard Law, McKinsey, to boots on the ground, running it, doing it?
Yeah. The biggest thing I had to unprogram is just the world operates in line with how you would intellectually perceive the world to operate. So when you're on a spreadsheet or when you're writing a business plan or whatever it is, it's all a function of, you know, how thorough did you do research? How, you know, in depth did you make the model, et cetera? And so you feel in control, right? Because you know, these variables, there's no counter variable that's happening at the same time. It's kind of a static, you know, static variable or static data set that you're really, you know, addressing against. In the real world, that's just not the case. Right? It's just not the case at all. I think the other really big thing that matters a lot is, you know, what is the context of your situation and what advice are you applying? So a lot of people talk about, you know, they'll throw things out like, you know, only hire A players. I've always struggled with that one, I'll be honest, right? Because I think there's a lot of people out there that, you know, want to do their job and they'll do their job well, but they want to go home at 5 o'clock and, you know, work is not their life and there's nothing wrong with that. And I guess you could categorize that as a B player, right? And so if you followed the advice too, you know, concretely, you'd be like, well, we shouldn't hire that person.
Maybe if you run a hedge fund, but like if you're running a laundromat roll-up business, like...
Yeah. And actually
Bill Belichick learned to win with C players.
Yeah, 100%. What you realize actually is it's not even about being an A player or B player. It's about setting the paradigm correctly.
Putting them
setting
in the position,
parameters correctly, right? So... Yeah, putting them in the position to succeed and recognizing that, you know, there are people out there that want to work a stable 40 hour, you know, a week work week and will do a great job. They'll show up, they'll do the work, they'll be respectful, they'll be responsible, et cetera. Yeah. And then they're good. They're good with going home and not, you know, and kind of turning off. And, you know, it's in part what makes us a little bit crazy as the entrepreneurs, right? Because we kind of hear that or think that and we're like, wow, 40 hours, like, that's insane. Like I'm going to work, you know, I'll work 100 hours if it takes, you know, that to get done. And so I think having the self-awareness, you know, and then being at places like McKinsey, Scott, and was very similar, right? For yourself, et cetera, being at places like that, everybody that's there is working 80 to 100 hours, right? And it's one archetype of person. And so what I had to gain a lot of empathy for was kind of dissecting this idea of, you know, let's say A player, B player versus, you know, on the paradigm that I was used to, which is, well, if you're not, you know, in the office until midnight and working really hard, et cetera, maybe you're a B player. I had to kind of, you know, twist and tweak some of those parameters, some of those biases, some of those assumptions that are in my own head. And I was only able to do that candidly as I got like smarter about how the world actually operates and a little bit out of the act.
I remember when I was in law school, I was taking a class and the professor really liked me and he told me I was going to get an A in the class. And so I thought about skipping class one day and like, I couldn't get myself, like it gave me anxiety. The thought of like going to class, even though it was like a totally futile thing, like it, you know, the outcome was already set. And I noticed that in myself, even after selling the business, like I don't have an operating thing with investors and people wanting quarterly reports or doing any of those things. That's been another thing that I kind of learned trying to like, you get swept up, and I've heard you talk about this before. You get swept up in other people's games. And even when even when entrepreneurs set their own game, a lot of times they set the rules so difficult against themselves because they're comparing it to highlight reels on social media or whatever the culprit is. But, you know, that's been something that I myself have, and I don't have a silver bullet answer. I mean, it's still something that like I deal with in terms of like learning to charge less hard. I have a 9-year-old, I got 2 5-year-old, you know, I have kids, I got family stuff, and like the economics are less pressure than they were quitting law, moving into my in-law's basement. But it's so easy to like keep that. And like that feeling feels so safe because it like motivates you, you know, like, no, like backs against the wall, like I gotta go, you know?
I think strengths and weaknesses are two sides of the same coin, right? And I think the importance is just being really thoughtful and conscious that the same thing that in one respect is a great strength. So whether it's, you know, insecurity, fear, scarcity, etc., these are all great strengths from the perspective of they really do push you, they motivate you, they force you, right, to endure in business. And I think if you don't have some grain or so of that,
yeah,
like you do get soft, you get comfortable, and it's required. The other side of that though is it can be a really strong weakness. If you have pervasive insecurity, if you consistently, you know, let fear drive your decision making, if you insularly, you know, neglect everything else in your life in kind of the sole pursuit, right, of business, again, whether it's for economic status, whatever that might be, it turns out that can be a really big weakness, right? Certainly in your professional life, but absolutely in your personal life. And so I've always tried to think of, and again, be just honest with emotions and conscious of emotions. So what are you feeling in the moment? Why are you thinking a certain way? And what is the good and the bad of that? Right. I think oftentimes people will give very trite perspective or trite advice of, you know, fear is bad. Well, it, you know, or insecurity is bad. Well, it turns out insecurity can be good and insecurity can be bad. It just depends on how are you, you know, toggling that emotion and how are you actually using it. Every emotional is ultimately a vehicle for some sort of action, right? Some sort of physical action or some sort of mental thought. And so how are you harnessing that emotion, right? Either for the physical action or for the emotional thought. I don't think any emotion in and of itself is a good or bad emotion. The output of that emotion is what, you know, kind of ultimately drives kind of good or bad, quote unquote. And so I think having that, you know, having that awareness and kind of understanding, you know, how are you actually leveraging the emotion itself and sometimes the compound nature of a singular emotion, right? And so if it's fear, what are the good parts of fear and what are the bad parts of fear, right? And how do kind of all those things, you know, coexist.
We were talking before we hit record in terms of like, and share how much you feel comfortable sharing. I know you take over this business as kind of this outside CEO that is kind of at a place that needs to put a lot of pieces in place in order to get it where everyone's expectations are. I myself am running a playbook of buying things because they have no enterprise value right now. And my goal is to build enterprise value. The big kind of weak link that I have to solve for in each of these is key man, key woman risk. And there are these online businesses that are mostly functioning because you have the solopreneur that's kind of, you know, created this out of nothing. What were the things that you did that got it to a place where it could have a transaction?
Yeah. I think there's different stages of this, right? So I think the first thing is you always, if you're looking at any business, and let's say you're trying to buy a business, you have to think about, you know, are you buying a job or are you buying a company? And you might not be buying a company on day one, right? But are you buying potential that this can be a company or are you buying a job, right? And so that's, you know, the belief. I think you have to have the belief if you're ever going to buy a business that it is a company or it can be a company, right? Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense to do, you know, with respect to alternative options. Once you do have that belief or that conviction that, okay, this can be a company, I think then you actually have to digest it. It's actually a very tactical, you know, everything we've talked about is kind of philosophical and I think super important, you know, from a mindset perspective of how you think about businesses. But there's a very tactical, pragmatic component to all of this too, right? Do you have the right people in place? Do you have the right processes in place? Do you have the right systems in place, right? Et cetera. You know, what, you know, and so we looked at every kind of nook and, you know, every nook under the sun, right? Every little crack under the sun, which was, you know, what's the pricing with every single customer? What, you know, what products does every customer have? Can we sell them more products, right? you know, who is managing these accounts? Are those people strong or those people weak, right? You know, we let go of people, we turned over the management team, right? We put in new processes, et cetera. All the while though, one thing I'm very thankful for, there's a little bit of a tangent, but this is related to your question. A guy named Brent Breeshore, who runs Permanent Equity, is a good friend. And I got his advice a lot. This was about 4 or 5 years ago when I was starting on this journey. And he told me, Ramin, whatever you do in the first 90 days, don't change a thing. And I'm so glad I listened to him. And I'm so glad he was there to tell me that, because that was transformative to the success of this journey. I had had an idea certainly before talking to Brent, and just, you know, again, in kind of this McKinsey mindset of I'm going to change this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, et cetera. And you really need a good perspective around, you know, what is the organization that you're in, and how is it operating? There's certain things that have happened for a really long time that one way to look at them is to say, oh, they can be improved, right? And, you know, how immature or how non-intellectual these, you know, folks must be that they haven't changed this. What I've learned is the counter side of that is, wow, if that's been working for so long, what am I missing that's actually making that thing work? Right. And how do I, in this pursuit of change or evolution or whatever it is, not, you know, change the 9 out of 10 things on the outside of the circle? I can change all of those and feel like we've made this big improvement. But in that process, I changed the 1 out of 10 things in the core of the circle that actually drove the whole, you know, value of this operation. Right. And so I think there's a very tactical and very pragmatic, you know, approach, playbook, et cetera, whatever you want to call it, to go through. Really in learning the core business, right? In really improving, you know, every operational element of the business. And then I think that's, you know, that's got to be reflected in the structure, the scale, you know, your economic aspirations, et cetera. Are you, you know, you can get something that's really, really dirty, messy, and hairy, and that should be reflected in your price and your structure and so on and so forth.
Right.
And it's going to take a lot of elbow grease. And you can take something that, you know, is actually quite clean and good, et cetera. And, you know, that's also going to be reflective in the price and the structure, et cetera. Right. So I think wherever you enter, you know, you have an aspiration of where you want to go and where you want to exit. And so you have to have a pretty clean line, you know, between that. Yale put out a paper this past week or the week before on search funds generally. And, you know, what are the levers that operators should really be thoughtful of, you know, in maximizing basically their own personal value and value for their investors, et cetera, when going through a search. And it was a really interesting paper because it talked, you know, it certainly talked obviously about, you know, entry price, exit multiples, et cetera. But it talked a lot about just the core, you know, internal levers that you can really drive in a business, right? And so I think you have to have a really good perspective of, you know, how are you going to get from A to B? And then, you know, if you're lucky enough to get to B, then I think you actually have some different types of options, right? You can continue to, you know, go about it as a bootstrapped entrepreneur. That was certainly an option on the table, you know, for us. You can go upon it by completely exiting your business and getting out of it. That was an option for us. And you could go about it, you know, taking on private equity and saying, how do we go from B to C, right? And ultimately that was the option we elected to take for ourselves because we continued to believe in the business. Right. And we continue to believe that you can continue. Actually, now it gets exciting and interesting from a compounding value perspective. Right. Because it turns out everything in life, everything in business costs twice as much, takes twice as long, and it's twice as hard. Right. But if you're fortunate enough to crack through, you know, on that journey, you know, you can kind of wake up one day and look back and say, wow, you know, in actually not that long of a period of time.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty unbelievable the value that was actually created. Right. So I think the parts of the journey are really important, right? For the question you asked, I think the parts of the journey really matter. I think it's, you know, if anybody is thinking about kind of entrepreneurship through acquisition or buying a boring business or whatever it might be, I think you have to be actually hyper, hyper disciplined, you know, around very, very tactically thinking through not only the business, but the risks of the business, how you're going to mitigate the risks of the business, you know, your perspectives on growth on the business, et cetera. And I think you have to be really attuned, you know, emotionally, because, you know, these businesses are businesses that are stewards of their community, right? Whether you like it or not, you know, and there's a really interesting kind of cultural element, you know, of this whole game that you can really lose out on or kind of miss, you know, if you're not attenuated to it.
What was the like?
If you're not thoughtful about
it. I know for me, I probably over-optimize on remaining in control. You know, you have a kind of power versus money on the grapefruit watermelon thing. I think as you went for the more kind of Goldilocks approach of private equity that comes in and you know, partners with you on that next stage of growth, how did you get yourself comfortable with ceding the control that's necessary? I guess, what are some of the best practices that you've learned in that process of kind of post-acquisition? Things that you'll take with you, things that you would prefer didn't exist. And then like, what, obviously this is like a 3-part hour long question that we don't have time for, but like, what pushed you over the edge to pull the trigger on that? And then what are some of kind of the detractions that you've seen? Cause I like to focus on the negative. I think there's more, like the negatives are usually more obvious. It's like constellation of, you know, good fortune and whatever. So where do you sit? How did you go about thinking about those things?
Yeah. So maybe it's worth sharing that framework that you alluded to, because I think that drives a lot of the kind of the tactical answer to your question, right? So I have this belief, I have two beliefs in business, or let's say two amongst several beliefs, but these two beliefs I think tie to this, which is one belief is in any business, you can solve for power or money. You can't solve for both. And so again, you have to be very intellectually honest with yourself about, do you want power? And if you want power, that's great, but you're going to leave economics on the table. And if you want economics, that's great, but you're not really going to be in control. It's always a side note, it's always funny to me when people say, oh, you know, the job I want is the CEO job. That's not the job you want. You have the hardest boss, right? Which is the market that does not care about your feelings, does not care about if you're having a good day, a bad day, et cetera. And there's no reprieve, right? If you mess up or you make a wrong decision, that's it. It can be a brutally devastating game as well, right? So I think you can choose power or money in business. I don't think you can choose both. I think, you know, that framework breaks if you really pressure test it when you think of like the Elon Musks or, you know, the Steve Jobs, et cetera, of the world, but that's a handful of entrepreneurs, right? This power and money framework parlays very closely to a fruit analogy I have that you mentioned also, which is, do you want a grape or do you want a slice of a watermelon? And if you want an entire grape, you're effectively choosing power, right? In control. And if you want a slice of a watermelon, it's much bigger fruit. You're choosing that you want a thing, a piece of a thing that is significantly larger, right? And that, by the way, the reason why I kind of spelled out power and money and you know, grape and watermelon is because it doesn't necessarily tie one to one. You can choose that you want a watermelon because you want to create more impact at scale. It has nothing to do with power or money, right? But that kind of concept of a watermelon, a slice of watermelon, basically means you want to be a part of something that's bigger than yourself. And because you're a part of something that's bigger than yourself, a slice of something that's bigger than yourself turns out to be bigger, you know, than just, you know, being insularly focused. So I dissected and kind of thought through the selection of private equity, number one, before selection of private equity firm, right? So selection of private equity through this framework. And what I ultimately came out to was, you know, having a thoughtful, sophisticated partner at the table that was hyper incentivized economically was actually going to be a really good thing. It was going to bring the right level of, you know, additional rigor and sophistication into the business. It was going to bring an accountability partner that is not there when you own your business entirely. And it was going to bring a set of expertise that I thought could be really instrumental in the next stage of the business, you know, primarily inorganic growth, right? Whether it was financing it, you know, another set of eyes and ears and brains at the table when evaluating companies for acquisition. And that was going to be a really key part, you know, of the growth story. So the first part was, you know, do we go with private equity, period, right? Then the second part, which is much more nuanced, is, well, how do you pick the right firm? And I'm really happy with the partners we picked. And I'm not saying that because we're on a podcast and it feels like I have to say that. Like, I'm genuinely actually very happy with the partners that we picked. And, you know, there were partners that we could have picked that, you know, I'm really glad we didn't go forward with, right? Because I think 1 year, you know, we did our transaction in June of 2022. I think 1 year from that, we're about a year and a month, you know, from that transaction, it could have been really bad. It could have been really terrible. We could have been super burned out, you know, depressed, not wanting to get up, come in because we have bad partners. And in fact, it's quite the opposite. You know, we're more energized than ever about the business. The partners are really great. you know, we've hired new members of the management team. They're doing great. And so it's really important to pick the right partners. I'd say the negative part, it hasn't really been negative, but it's different, is, you know, again, it's not your fiefdom anymore, right? And so there is reporting, and there are board meetings, and, you know, there are, you know, decisions that you may not see eye to eye on, and you have to figure out how you work through them, right? I mean, every decision, you know, we don't sit across the table and say, yep, we think about it 100% the same way, and let's just go do that. But that's a good thing too, right? That really pushes and pressure tests, you know, are we making the right decision for the business? So it is, it's definitely harder to operate. You know, you don't have your own just kind of internal self to say, yeah, I feel like doing this, or I think this is the right thing. Intuition, let's go do it. There's often times where I've thought, hey, this is the right thing. And then, you know, one of the members of my board says, okay, well, prove it to us, right? And we have to go through kind of the painstaking exercise of, you know, let's show the data, or why, you know, this customer, or X, Y, or Z, or so. But it's gotten us to, you know, outcomes which were confirmed, which was good, kind of confirmatory internal diligence. It's gotten us to outcomes which we've changed, which was really helpful. And it's gotten us to permutations of the same idea, right? That was a track that we just weren't seeing had we not gone, you know, further and deeper, which was a bigger, you know, more attractive mountain to climb than the initial one we thought. So I think it's hard. I think working with partners is hard. I think it's very oversimplified on the challenge and the difficulty of working with partners. And I think it requires a lot of thought to work correctly and well with partners. But if you can work correctly and well with partners, I'm very convinced, having seen both sides of it now, that the outcomes can be so much greater and so much greater, so much faster with the right partners, you know, around the
table. I think for me, going from King of the Castle to, and again, I didn't have I was in big law for 9 months, and I was like, I'll go do anything else that's not this. And so obviously it's not structurally the same as having a boss, but of my buddies that have, you know, sold to private equity, but kind of remain around, whether it's a rollover equity deal where they still, you know, a lot of economics at the second bite of the apple, you know, managing that, which is mostly just if you're interpreting it like, these are my bosses now, and I have to say, mother, may I, to these, you know, for you, who's obviously super accomplished, and you have a portfolio manager that just graduated from accounting somewhere, you know, it's like asking you for, you know, there's like, you have to, I guess, swallow a lot of pride.
You have to navigate it. And that's why I think the selection of partners is really important. So our partners, you run a firm called ArcView Capital in New York City. And they, traditional private equity guys, came from TPG, KKR, you know, Citadel, great schools, you know, Wharton, HBS, et cetera. Kind of the check the box, if you were to put together a white shoe private equity resume, these guys check the box, right? But the most important thing was they were senior members of the Ziff Brothers family office in New York City for the last decade. And that was really compelling to me in the selection of a private equity firm, because they really took a long-term orientation and not a traditional private equity playbook, you know, to bear. Right. And so while they're hyper-focused on growth and, you know, being thoughtful of, you know, using every financial toolkit that we can, you know, to create value and, you know, how do we drive value, et cetera. They're, you know, they're long-term oriented players, right? Which philosophically, right, was really important in how we run the business. So the relationship is not, you know, mother, may I have a boss relationship, right? The relationship is much more of, you know, we're collaborative partners and we're working together, you know, to really continue to grow this business and do well for our employees and our customers and, you know, and ourselves, of course, right? And kind of everybody that's associated. But the dynamic is very different than, you know, what could have been the case, which were other private equity firms that I was talking to that, you know, had, you know, my former analyst at McKinsey, that was probably the first year associate that would have been the one asking for the details on the reporting package. And I'll be honest, I don't know if I could have mentally gone from having that person as an analyst on my team to feeling like I reported to them, you know, and especially because in the intermittent years, money, you know, we grew and scaled the business pretty well, right? It would have felt a little bit odd. It would have felt a little bit odd, right? And so I think ultimately this is also something that kind of feeds into my mind quite a bit, which is, I think all these decisions end up being much more about
you know, who is ultimately the player in the game, right? So private equity is strategic. What kind of structure with private equity? You know, is it a first-time fund? Is it a growth fund? Is it established? Is it late stage? Blah, blah, blah. Like, it's all, it doesn't matter, right? All of it that matters is who is the person that's on your board? Who is the person you are working with? And what is, candidly, their influence and their shaping in their firm, right? I have two of the co-founders of the firm on my board. And that was a big decision. That was a big, you know, calculus in the decision, because I knew that it wouldn't be a situation that, you know, Raleigh and I really agreed.
Right.
But, you know, Raleigh's managing director just doesn't see eye to eye. And I'm not going to get the time of day to talk to Raleigh's managing director. So who really cares at the end of the day what we're talking about? Because the decision's going to be made by somebody else. Right. So it's important. I think if you pick the red, if you don't pick the right partners, business is already hard enough. I think without having good partners, it is. It can be excruciatingly.
I want to be respectful of your time. Where do you see yourself in the next little bit? What are the things that you're thinking that you want to impress on, whether it's somebody who's looking to quit their job or somebody who's trying to think about selling their business or somebody who's entering law school, three very different stages. Where's your head at these days? What's the thing that's pressing on you mentally that you want to get the message out to?
Yeah, I think part of why, you know, I started a newsletter, I started writing, you know, so much on things like Twitter, et cetera, is because, you know, retrospectively, and again, knock on wood, again, I credit my parents in many respect, and I, you know, balls have bounced in very favorable ways over the last 15 years to kind of end up in the situation I've ended up in. And we were talking about this before we pressed recording. This man, if balls bounced two more, you know, directions to the right, what an amazingly different outcome it would have been, even to a next level scale. And if balls bounced two steps to the left, you know, I'm probably not even interesting enough to be on this podcast, candidly, right? So there's a lot of humility and gratitude for that. And I think if you look at my story, it feels like it all kind of was this like up into the right, et cetera, but it was filled with insecurity, doubt, confusion, you know, et cetera, all along the way. And, if I retrospectively look at it and look at that journey, and there are certain things that were very intentional moves that I am proud of that worked out in the grand scheme of things or in retrospect, that's the most important, you know, kind of feeling or flavor that I think is there just that I want to impart to more people, which is, you know, if you just believe in yourself and you put your own effort in, like the analogy you gave at the beginning is actually the perfect way to articulate it, which is the world is not Cinderella, right? The world is not, you know, wait until midnight and the glass slipper will just come, et cetera. But the world is absolutely one in which if you go take it or try to take it and you do it enough times and you stay in the game, like, I don't know, we're still young enough where, you know, we have a whole, you know, stage of our career ahead of us and our life ahead of us, but we've seen enough, right? I have not seen enough in my friend groups or people I am aware of, acquaintance or whatever it is, over the last 15 years, where if you stayed in the game and you wanted it badly enough and you kept pounding your head painfully against the cement, it didn't work out in some respect for you. Now, the scale at which it worked out, the timing at which it worked out, you know, all those things, you know, are different. It's as much about, you know, project selection and skill as it is just luck and circumstances, right? Let's put all that to the side. But I have not seen someone that says, I want to take it. I want this badly enough. And I'm going to have the patience and humility to stay in the game long enough. And maybe along the way, take, you know, detours and drops that are not obvious. I have not seen anybody that has followed those, let's say, 3, 4, 5 criteria, and it's not worked out at some level of scale. And I think that's such a mentality thing as opposed to anything anybody teaches you in school or in a classroom, et cetera. And so what I get motivated by and interested by is just, you know, how many people are out there that if they had the right push and a little bit of guidance, et cetera, you know, it's not just they would make a lot more money, but they would just live a life that's better suited for them. And then at this like very weird macro level, and not that I'm going to be the sole person that has this kind of impact on the world, but at a weird macro level, sometimes I like in a very kind of McKinsey-esque way, I think of, well, if you sized that and let's say you impacted X number of people, like how much better would the world be? And like, isn't that better for all of us? Like that feels like a logical, you know, kind of extension. Like not that I'm going to be the one, you know, singularly that does that, but like people like you are doing that, right? I think people like me are doing that. There's a lot of people that are doing that through mechanisms like this, podcasts and writing about your story and getting involved with entrepreneurs. And if everybody's doing that, like, it feels like, you know, again, maybe this is like the idealist and the utopian in me, but it feels like the world should be better.
Just a question,
right?
Of,
like, it just feels like that should be.
It's just a question of, are there more impacted people or windows in New York City? And which one is higher?
and which metric is winning? Yeah, that's exactly it. So I think that's the main thing. That's the main thing that I want to impart on people is, you know, go for it, right? Like, believe in yourself, take intentionality, right? And it sounds super pithy, right? Which is like, it feels like it's like we're ending on a graduation speech, but I really believe it, right? Like you should believe in yourself, you should go for it, and you should, you know, you should fight and claw for interesting opportunities and put yourself in a position where, like, you know, things will work out, and they'll work out at some level of scale. And again, being honest with yourself throughout that entire journey, right? Being super honest with yourself. There's nothing wrong with wanting to, you know, working 40 hours a week and, you know, doing all these other things, or saying that, you know, my career or job is not actually the principal driver in my life or so. There's nothing wrong with that. I think people trash that way too much. And we have a great company because we have so many people like that, right? That is their life's aspiration, and they contribute, you know, to the mission and the business in such a meaningful way. And that's great, right? I think the most important thing is just be super honest with yourself. And if you're honest with yourself about, hey, I do want to be an entrepreneur. Maybe I do want to have, you know, outsized career success or economic success or whatever it is. Well, pony up, because it's hard, right? Like, it's going to take a long time, and it's not easy mentally. It's not easy, you know, physically, like from an endurance perspective, it's not easy, you know, day in and day out. But go for it, right? Like, you should go for it, because if you don't go for it, you're ultimately going to be like, you're just going to live a life of regret. So that's a very long-winded way of saying, like, I like writing online and I like sharing this information, because I do think there's a lot of people out there that, you know, if you had a little bit more structure or a little bit more guidance, which something, you know, like online, it enables you to do in 2023.
Which you can have anything that you want in life, just not everything. And if you pick something and you focus on it long enough and you really go for it, that you'll get it and you'll improve your situation massively. Dude, I appreciate the time massively. I read every single one of your newsletters, so please keep doing it. I know I've had my own creator thing of like, I don't want to do it anymore. I quit, you know, like 3 months later, pick it back up. So please keep doing it, because I can't wait for the next one.